When Laura Ingalls Wilder picked up her pen to write about her childhood on the prairies of the Midwestern frontier, she had no idea that her stories would move millions and span generations. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The well-read books of Laura Ingalls Wilder sit on the shelves of libraries, classrooms, and homes all over the world. Now, a new edition of her complete works has been released by the Library of America, edited by my guest today, Carolyn Frazier. I'll talk with her about the importance of these books. I'll also talk with Iowa's preeminent expert on Laura Ingalls Wilder, Sarah Utoff, and we want to hear from you. What makes these books so special? Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When we were kids, many of us crossed the prairie with Pa, Ma, Laura, Mary, little baby Carrie, and of course the good old bulldog Jack. The works of Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House in the Big Woods, Little House on the Prairie, and the others have endured for generations. They have now taken their place in the collection of the Library of America. A new edition of the complete works of Laura Ingalls Wilder has just been published, and the editor of that collection, Caroline Frazier, is here with me today. Hello, Caroline.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me.
And Caroline will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Iowa City Public Library in a visit co-sponsored by Prairie Lights Bookstore. When did you first read these books?
I read them when I was a kid, and my sister had read them before me and sort of helped me read them and told me about the sad parts in advance so that I wouldn't be too scared.
Emotionally prepare you.
Yeah. And then I actually went on and read them as an adult as well.
What brought you back to them as an adult?
Well, I heard a story actually on NPR, on National Public Radio, in the 90s about a fellow who'd written a biography of Rose Wilder Lane, Laura Ingalls Wilder's daughter. And in it, he argued that Lane was really the co-author or author of the books, was really her mother's ghostwriter. And I was shocked to hear this and was really curious about what the story was behind that. And ended up doing some research looking at the original manuscript and writing an article about that.
And when you went back to those original manuscripts, what did you find?
Well, as I went through the manuscripts that were available on microfilm, it seemed to me that the story was actually somewhat more complicated than he had portrayed it, this biographer whose name was William Holtz. If those manuscripts did not exist, then I think you could make an argument that Lane really was the ghostwriter. But because they exist and because Laura clearly had such an intense involvement with her own material, and since she produced the original manuscripts from which the books were created, I really don't think that you can call her daughter a ghostwriter. They certainly did collaborate, though. Rose played a very important editorial role, really guided her mother and taught her mother some of the tools and the techniques of writing fiction, you know, sort of taught her how to write dialogue and helped her learn how to structure the book. So she played a very important role.
When you went back to the books, and obviously you went back to do research, but again, you revisited the material. How had it changed for you from childhood?
It seemed a little darker to me, I think, as an adult. When you read them as a kid, I think you take it all at face value. You feel the sort of triumphs that the kids had, and you love the adventure stories, but you don't see it really from an adult perspective. But when you read them when you're older, I think you see more of the history that's behind them, some of which is quite disturbing and tragic. And you also see a little bit more clearly what they went through. I mean, the everything that could go wrong went wrong for these people in many, many ways. And I think you realize how tough that really must have been, that she made it acceptable for children, that she made it somewhat more upbeat than it probably was in real life.
When you return to books that you read as a child, as an adult, and particularly someone like you with your PhD in English and, you know, a lot of background in writing and literature, when you went back to read them, what did you think of the writing?
I was impressed by it, actually. I don't think that really registered with me as much when I was a kid either, but they're really beautifully written. The descriptions of the landscape are incredibly lyrical and beautiful, and there's a real sense of love of these places, which were hard to love. I mean, the Great Plains presented, you know, really a terrifying prospect to a lot of people. Not very many people came to the Great Plains and really appreciated them for what they were. You know, many of the settlers either washed out and went home or really struggled to survive. And of course, it was a struggle for the Ingalls family as well. But Laura had a real capacity for appreciation and love of the land, which is quite unusual.
How did you get chosen to be the editor of this collection?
Well, I think that the Library of America looks for people who have some academic credentials, but also people who have an understanding of what the general audience that comes to these works, maybe without any appreciation or familiarity with them, maybe not seeing them as, you know, beloved kids' books. But I think that they want to, at the Library of America, and I think they do a good job with this, to open up the history of these works of literature and really give people some tools in which to kind of find out a little bit more about these works.
When you decided to take on this project, how did you go about it, editing these books that have been printed and published so many times all over the world?
I really did have to learn more of the history than I knew and go and read some materials about the Osage Indians in Kansas and the history of the Homestead Act and materials about the Minnesota Massacre, for example, which is mentioned several times in Little House on the Prairie, and really delve into those topics so that I would be able to write some notes on those things in an accurate and balanced way.
Did you change anything in the text of these books, or was it primarily researching so that you could write notes that put these events into the historical context?
Well, we did several things. I wrote a fairly extensive chronology of Wilder's life, which you can read along with the books and the notes and some publishing history as well. But we did correct the text for the first time since 1953. And by correct, I mean just corrected typos. And there's a list at the back of all the changes that we made, which were fairly minor. But there were typographical errors in the 1953 edition, which was illustrated by Garth Williams and is still the
classic
edition,
the
readily available edition for kids.
Going back and making those changes, what did that feel like to jump into this collection that, you know, you approached as a child, just like all the rest of us did, and it really holds this iconic status?
You know, every time I read it, and I read it multiple times in the course of doing this editorial work, I found new things that I had either, you know, glossed over the first time or missed, or, you know, there's so much in there and so many little details that you pick up on. I was really fascinated by the ecological history that's presented in the books and the portrayal of wolves, which turn up in really every volume that she published during her lifetime. And a lot of that had just sort of gone right by me before. So I was really, every time I read it, I find something new.
When you found new things, did that send you in new directions in your research?
Yeah, I really, you know, for the first time, I learned a lot about the locust plague that plays such a central role in the novel On the Banks of Plum Creek. I had never realized before what a huge event in American history that was and what a national catastrophe it really represented. So there were a number of really sort of fascinating avenues that opened up.
With the ecological descriptions that you're talking about, you have a background in this. A few years ago, you published a book called The Rewilding of the World, which is about restoring wild places. And when I've read the books recently with my daughter, I was really struck by her description of the native prairie. And she really seemed to be moved by it in a way that you don't find in a lot of settlers' accounts.
Yeah, that's very true. I think the only other writer I can think of who really has the same feeling for the plains is Willa Cather, who wrote about them also with an appreciation for their beauty. But Laura Ingalls Wilder was really, she came along at a really interesting time because the plains had already been altered by the time she saw them. The buffalo were nearly gone. Beaver had been wiped out. You know, wolves were really on their way out. So the whole ecology of the place was being altered. And I think you see that in the locust plague because that was probably made more severe by the droughts that were beginning to occur, which may have been related to the wholesale conversion of the plains to agriculture. So it's a very interesting moment where she sees the grasslands kind of as they once were, but not completely as they once were. And she sees how beautiful they are and responds to what she sees happening, which is the disappearance of wildlife. You know, the birds kind of disappear as the town gets established, the town of DeSmet in Dakota Territory. And so it's a beautiful descriptive work about that place, but it's also tinged with sadness and a yearning to be able to see it before all these changes happened.
I'm talking with Caroline Fraser. She is the editor of a new edition of the complete works of Laura Ingalls Wilder that's just been published by Library of America. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We're going to bring Sarah Utoff into the conversation. She's a reference librarian at Kirkwood Community College. She's also a Wilder historian, and she actually does performances as Laura Ingalls Wilder as well. And we want to hear from you. We want to know why you think these books are so special. Why do they hold a special place in literature and in our history? 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the works of Laura Ingalls Wilder. A new edition of the complete works of Wilder has just been published by Library of America. The editor of that collection, Caroline Fraser, is here with me today. She'll also be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Iowa City Public Library in a visit co-sponsored by Prairie Lights Bookstore. And also with us now is Sarah Utoff. She's a reference librarian at Kirkwood Community College. She's the director of the Oxford Library, and she's also an expert on the life and works of Laura Ingalls Wilder. She even takes on the persona of Laura Ingalls Wilder and gives speeches and performances all over the Midwest. Sarah, thanks for coming back to the show.
Oh, I'm always glad to come in here. And you know me, I cannot pass up an opportunity to talk about Laura.
Well, let's go back to when you first found these books. When did you first read them?
Well, I first had the books read to me before I can even really remember. Someone had told my mom, well, if you're going to have a little girl, you have to get this set of books. So she found them at a garage sale and brought them home, and everybody started reading them to me, my mom and both sets of my grandparents. And I sort of got obsessed right away. Grandma Utoff made me a little Laura doll, and my grandpa Utoff made me a covered wagon, and my grandmother on the other side made me a Laura dress, and I was just taken completely over. And my mom, who was also very, very supportive, took me around to all the home sites when I was just a little kid.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of Laura fans didn't get that much support, so I was very lucky.
But these weren't something that your mom had read when she was little.
No, she read The Black Stallion, as she keeps telling me. And I tell her she had 10 years between when she was born and when Laura died. She could have written her a letter and gotten a response back.
A missed opportunity.
Yes.
Why do you think that these books grabbed you in a way that clearly they've never let go?
Well, I get that question a lot, and it's very hard for me to answer because I don't understand why everybody isn't that fascinated. Because there's just, I think probably the best answer is there's just so much there. I always say they're kind of like The Simpsons. Every time you go back, there's something else to find. And as long as you keep your eyes open, there's people love the food, people love the family, people love the beauty of nature, people like that Laura affirms it's okay to be scared and go ahead and do it anyway. I mean, there's just everybody wants to be Laura if they've actually read the books. And boys who will not read most books because if they have a girl protagonist will sometimes read the Little House books. At least they will read Farmer Boy and decide that they're sort of okay.
One of the things, Caroline, that you mentioned in an interview that you did was how interesting Laura's relationship with her father is. And it's true that when you go back to books from this time period, often the fathers are missing or minor characters, or if you go back just a couple of years before in the history of you know, when these events took place, they were away at war. But what do you think makes this portrayal of her relationship with her father special?
Well, I think that they had a great respect for each other, and she really does do a great job of painting a portrait of him as both a kind of, you know, loner. I mean, he's always going out, going off hunting by himself, but he's also, you know, the best kind of father in terms of, you know, that he comes back. He tells them these amazing stories. You know, Little House in the Big Woods is full of Pa's stories about his childhood and the trouble that he got into when he was a boy and the naughty things his own father did. And he's such a kind figure. And it's true that for one reason or another, in most of children's literature, fathers are a little questionable many times. I mean, they're either absent or sometimes they're even, you know, actively wicked and sort of a bad, you know, influence on their kids or mean. And Pa, I think Charles Ingalls was both in real life and in the books, the sort of quintessential idealized father figure.
Well, and last time you were on the show, Sarah, we talked a lot about Charles and his life. I mean, he led his family all over the Midwest. He made some very questionable decisions, but yet in the books, he does come off as this idealized figure.
Well, I think he was the fun parent for most of the time Laura was growing up, and he got to go off and do interesting things. And that was very different than Ma, who got stuck trying to make all these things work, which Laura comes to appreciate in the last few volumes of the set. But early on, you know, it's hard for a kid to see that. And I think it was also reinforcing because here was this guy who went off and did cool stuff, but he came back and he spent time with his girls, Laura especially, but with really all of the girls. And I think that is really reaffirming for people. It really is one of the things I think that people keep coming back to the books for, especially people who didn't have that kind of family. And they sort of get at least a taste of it, of what they're longing for vicariously through the Ingalls.
Caroline, when you went back and put together the chronology of Laura's life and her travels across the Midwest. I mean, there are moves that didn't make it into books. She left out periods of time. The time that she lived in Iowa, in fact, didn't make it into the books. Were you surprised by how much this family moved?
Yeah, you do have to question some of Charles Ingalls' decisions. Occasionally, you wonder, and I think we don't really know in some cases why he did what he did. And since we don't have the information, it's hard to really, you know, see what he was up to. But, you know, one of the things that became clear to me in putting the books back in their proper order of publication is that Little House in the Big Woods and Farmer Boy both emphasize how well off, relatively speaking, those families, the Ingalls and the Wilders, were early on in the childhood of Laura and Almanzo, that they really had enough to eat, and they had stability, they had security, the Ingalls did, in Wisconsin. And then all of a sudden, you know, they pull up stakes and go to Kansas. And I think that the books follow a kind of arc, you know, after that initial sense of security, where there's this complete, you know, loss of security and really the families face real privation and want, which she doesn't fully acknowledge even in the books, how close they were at various points to starving. And so it's interesting to see how that arc plays out and how she tries to restore the sense of stability at the end.
Well, and when you read the books as a child, the idea of living in a dugout with a dirt floor underneath a hill in the middle of the prairie sounds pretty fun. And when you think about that as an adult, that those conditions were stark and incredibly difficult. We're talking today about the works of Laura Ingalls Wilder. A new edition of the Complete Works has just been published by Library of America. The editor of the collection, Caroline Fraser, is here with me today. Sarah Utoff is here as well, Iowa's preeminent expert on Laura Ingalls Wilder, in my personal estimation. And we want to hear from you as well. Join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Why have these books played an important part in your life? If they have. Maybe you've come back to them with your children. You're seeing them in a new way. We'd love to hear your impressions. We'd also love to know why you think they have endured. Why have they endured for generations and generations? Why have they gone around the world and been translated into so many different languages? Why do they resonate with people in 2012? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And to return to the environmental descriptions, the ecological descriptions that Laura gives, I was also struck in rereading the books recently by her father's relationship with nature, because the reason that is given in the book that he wants to move on is that the big woods have gotten too crowded and the game is disappearing, the wild animals are disappearing. He seems to be driven by a very close attachment to wild places.
Yeah, he seemed to have a sort of idealized view of nature and of the man in nature, of being able to sort of go out, you know, by himself and go hunting and commune with the larger the world. And she seems to have adopted that as well, Laura. I mean, there are so many scenes in the books where she goes out walking either by herself or with her sisters, and sort of rhapsodizes about the grasslands, the water, the Silver Lake, you know, and later with Almanzo, who also seems to share that propensity. So it's again, you know, it's a really you know, somebody, Garth Williams, once said that she never glamorized anything, but she saw the loveliness in everything. And I think that that's very true of her relationship to nature.
And Sarah, as people memorialize Laura and these books. And you mentioned traveling around to the different home sites, and there are many museums that are dedicated to different home sites and dedicated to her work and her life. One of the things that I notice in looking at these different museums is there seems to be an effort to recreate Native Prairie so that people who visit these areas can get an idea of what it looks like. And of course, the pioneers, as they were crossing the plains, they were transforming the land. And that was their goal, to transform the land and turn it into a place where they could farm. But do you think that these books have created a nostalgia for what the land was like before the pioneers came?
I think that is probably a reasonable thing to say, because as you're quite right that there's a lot of prairie plantings at most of the museums. Part of that is just in a practical matter because of the CRP program, if I can get it out. But part of it is that people do want to see the prairie, especially if you can get out to Desmet, where they have the Ingalls Homestead, which was the original farm that Pa homesteaded there. And a big part of that is prairie now again. And you can go walking out just sort of exactly like Laura did. And that is really always a really wonderful feeling. I did want to follow up on something you said, though, because a lot of times people, because they don't really know their own family history and they don't know the history of the country, kind of look at the Ingalls as being different now. But as Rose said herself, that the Ingalls and the Wilder families were just pretty typical. We look at it now and say Pa moved around a lot. And yeah, some of his decisions weren't the greatest. But people then weren't saying, oh, man, you moved there. They were saying, yeah, well, you just kept trying, because that's just sort of the accepted thing. And I think that's another thing that we get from the books, is it's just sort of a typical family, what happened. And if you don't know your own family's history from that time, I think a lot of people borrow the Ingalls family. And they use that sort of as their, if you don't know anything else about history, you get people who know we'll refer to it with Laura Ingalls Wilder, even if all they know is they walked through a room once that had the TV show going in the corner. When I was at the Jamestown settlement a couple years ago, which is about 2,000 miles and 200 years wrong for Laura, that's what the dad said when the family came in. Oh, look, girls, there's a fireplace just like Laura Ingalls Wilder.
And speaking of the TV show, you're not a big fan, Caroline.
No, I'm afraid not. When I look at it now, I'm struck by how, I mean, it is a very reminiscent of the 1970s. I mean, it seems to me more about the 1970s.
Feathered hair. And
yeah, than about the 1870s. So
interesting. How do you feel about the series?
Well, when I was a little kid, I really liked it, but even though I have a lot of friends who really still like this series, I don't think it holds up well. And you got to kind of understand, Michael Landon was trying to recreate Bonanza down to reusing scripts. So it has a lot more to do with that, especially after the first season. The pilot movie, excellent job, does a great job portraying the book. After that, it's sort of Bonanza.
Yeah. Jason is on the line from Iowa City at 866-780-9100. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
I was kind of curious about the relationship between Laura and Almanzo as it was portrayed in the books. She spends a lot of time describing the beauty of the landscape and that sort of thing, but there's not really any romantic description of the relationship between her and Almanzo. And I was wondering, was that just because of the way Laura was, or was that a genre choice because it was a children's book, or why was that the way that was presented?
Caroline, what's your take on that?
Well, I think there are sort of descriptions that make sense for somebody writing the books in the early 1940s. There are sort of romantic descriptions of them courting and going out on buggy rides together. And that clearly was as far as she was willing to take it. In the ninth novel, The First 4 Years, about their relationship after they married, which was not published during Wilder's lifetime, that becomes a little bit more realistic. She never prepared that manuscript for publication. And she does sort of talk a little bit more openly, not openly in the way that we think of it now with today's relative openness, but for her time, it was a kind of acknowledgement of both the fact that they were in love and also an acknowledgement of some of the difficulties they had.
Sarah, do you have something you want to add?
Well, I think in the books, part of it is just that she's writing kids, and part of it is that it is private. I think some of the most loving things that you find from him are in sort of her later life that she recorded. There's a book called Little House Traveler, and in it includes her diary of a trip that she and Manley took back to DeSmet in the 1930s. And she definitely, you know, is still quite smitten with him, with just what she says in there. And after as he got older, he got sicker, and she didn't want anybody else to be taking care of him. She was taking care of him. And after he died, they had twin beds, but after he died, she started sleeping in his. And I think that it definitely was a partnership and a romantic marriage.
Jason, thank you so much for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back in a moment. Today, we're talking about the works of Laura Ingalls Wilder. With me, Caroline Fraser, who is the editor of the new collection published by Library of America, and Sarah Utoff, who's a reference librarian at Kirkwood Community College, and she also takes on the persona of Laura Ingalls Wilder and performs as her around the Midwest. We'd love to hear from you as well. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me today, Caroline Fraser. She's the editor of a new edition of the collection of Laura Ingalls Wilder, published by Library of America. She'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Iowa City Public Library in a visit co-sponsored by Prairie Lights Bookstore. Sarah Utoff is also here with me today. She's a reference librarian at Kirkwood Community College and the director of the Oxford Library, also an expert on the life and works of Laura Ingalls Wilder, and she's the host of the Trundlebed Tales podcast as well. And we have a lot of people on the line who want to talk about these books at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to go first to Pam in West Des Moines. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
Hi, and your son wants to talk to us?
He does. We homeschool. We've read all the books, both he and my daughter, and he had a question. So I'll pass you over to my son, Jordan.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, I was wondering about the series afterward, telling about how Laura and Almanza settled down in the Ozarks. I was just wondering about how the writer of that collection came about the information.
Okay. What he's talking about is some of the spin-off series. If you're not familiar with children's literature, you may not know that HarperCollins tried to... I'm trying to think of a polite way to say it.
Capitalize
on the popularity of the books by creating a series of books about Rose and Ma and her grandmother and her great-grandmother. Now, specifically, the Rose books are said to be authored by Roger Lee McBride. He actually hired a ghostwriter to write them with him. And he, of the spinoff series, it probably has the most chance of being accurate because he based a lot of it off of the last couple books that Laura wrote on the way home. And he also put in some stuff from stories that Rose had told him. Roger Lee McBride was very close with Rose Wilder Lane, who was Laura's daughter. In fact, he inherited the estate, basically. But I heard him speak about this, and he just made up stuff, too. I would not take anything from any of the spinoff series on face value as far as if you were doing actual fact.
Jordan, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
How old are you, Jordan? Are you still there?
Yes, I'm 11.
All right. And are you a fan of these books?
Yes.
Why do you think that you like them so much?
Well, I just like the reference back to when, even though the prairie was not as wild as it used to be, just when it when people didn't rely on so many electrical gadgets.
So it makes you feel like a little bit nostalgic for a time when you had to go out there and really make your way in the world?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jordan, thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
And next we're going to go to Judy on the line in LeClaire. Hello, Judy.
Hi. I just wanted to share the experience that I had reading the books with my daughter starting when she was in second grade to like fourth grade. And it was a great bedtime routine, and we actually slowed down so that we could stretch them out and make them last as long as possible. And then we culminated reading of the books by taking a trip to the homestead in Missouri, and it just has very fond memories of us and for us, and I'd encourage anybody to do that.
Oh, Judy, what a great story. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
And I want to read this email from Heidi. She says, I read the books over and over again as a child in the 1970s and then again as an adult in my 30s and 40s. What I think makes the book so popular is that Laura is such a great role model for girls. She's a little bit of a tomboy, not afraid to explore the outdoors, stands up for what is right consistently, and is constantly struggling with the moral code of life as a child struggles with it. Respect for parents, jealousy of a sibling, pain and sadness when something terrible happens to your sibling, and the guilt as well. Mending of this relationship, standing up for those who are weaker, getting even with a playmate or fellow student who's rude and haughty. We all live through these things, and she tells them through a child's eye, and we see her struggle. And I mean, Laura is scrappy. She is tough. She does things that are not particularly ladylike. As a young feminist role model, do you think that that's an important part of how these books endure, Caroline?
Oh, definitely. And I think that was a great description. The books really, there's a lot of stuff about domesticity in the books and becoming a sort of, you know, polite and quiet young lady. But there's also a lot of rejection of that. You know, Laura really struggled with her own tomboy tendencies and also just, you know, the sense that she had to kind of buckle down and become very dutiful and work for her sister's, you know, welfare to try and send her sister, Mary, who was blind, to a college. And, you know, that struggle to really control yourself is a huge part of the theme of the books.
And Sarah, if I remember correctly from last time we talked, she fictionalized some things in writing these books, but she also made herself a little more at fault in many situations than maybe she had been growing up. She kind of made Mary the perfect character and put all of the naughtiness and fault into Laura.
Yeah, she was very... for instance, there's a scene in Long Winter where they have this conversation about whether the weather is savage or not and what exactly that means. And Laura said in other writings that she actually switched that around, that it was Mary who had said it felt savage, and she had sort of been less sure of that as a definition for the weather. But that was a much more Laura-like thing to say. So things that were Laura-like got put on Laura, and things that were Mary-like got put on Mary, no matter who did them. I think in real life, they were a little bit more balanced than they're presented in the books.
Well, and no one can be as perfect as Mary was,
no.
I think. we have Annette on the line from Kensett now. Hello, Annette.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
I grew up with my grandmother reading me the books, and my grandparents put up a log cabin on their house that they had moved from where Interstate 35 was going through. So we kind of experienced some of the things that Laura did. We had Thanksgiving in it with all of our homegrown things. And I really enjoyed the books growing up, and tomorrow I'm going to be doing a performance of one of my relatives' speeches that she used to give to women's clubs in the 1900s about pioneering at Silver Lake, Iowa, in Worth County in the 1850s. And talked about some of the same things, the prairies changing and the birds disappearing and the rattlesnakes and the leaving of the Indians.
So your family left you a legacy of this kind of writing as well.
Yes, this family also left their Civil War diaries and the father's diaries of the ship coming over. We even have the boat tickets.
Oh, wow. What a treasure.
Yeah, it's incredible. But, I mean, the Laura books, my grandmother reading them to me were just incredible closeness and growing with my grandparents.
Oh, where are you? Where's your performance tomorrow, Annette?
It's at a nursing home at Manly, the care center over there.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your call today.
Thank you.
And I want to read an email here from Kathy. She says, I first heard these books when my mother read them to us at bedtime when my sisters and I were young. They were the only books that I remember her reading to us. And when I think about it now, I believe it was because she enjoyed the descriptions of the prairie life. She herself grew up in Montana and Colorado. In Montana, her family lived within sight of the Little Bighorn battlefield. And in her stories of her childhood, she told us of taking hikes up to the battlefield, walking through the woods, hills, and streams. So I think the Little House books brought back memories of her own childhood. But it's interesting, so many of the stories that we're getting today are about reading these books out loud with their families. And Sarah, that's your story as well. And sometimes this has been happening in families for generations. So in a way, when you were saying that maybe we turn the Ingalls family into our ancestors, it strikes me that these books also represent family togetherness in a real and modern way as well.
Sure. And so many people have personal connections to the history in one way or the other. You know, my relatives were Swedish and Norwegian immigrants who farmed in Minnesota. So, you know, a lot of people knew people who lived this kind of life. And I mean, for me, it was a fascinating sort of introduction to the fact that a lot of this was really tough. You know, my grandmother didn't even really like to talk about her childhood. She didn't remember it fondly because it was such hard work, and she was glad to be done with that. And, you know, that was a sort of amazing insight into, you know, how really difficult those times were for a lot of people.
Well, and there are people who criticize these books because of the idealization of this time period and their lives. When you mentioned Willa Cather earlier, her books in O Pioneers and My Antonia, although she writes lovingly about the land, she also shows a much starker environment, and the family struggles are maybe not more difficult, but they're told in a way that makes them feel more difficult. Laura kind of skips over some of the really terrible things that happened in her life. You know, the scarlet fever takes place while you're not reading the book. You come back and you discover what has happened and that Mary has lost her sight. And you know that something horrible has gone on, but you maybe don't feel it viscerally like you do in some of these other works. Sarah, what's your take on that?
Well, I think if you actually... It's not the impression people get from the books. They come away with the books of warmth and cuddliness and quilting and making better. But if you actually read the books and look at the story, horrible things happen all the time. Laura almost gets drowned in a flood. They get sick. She did skip a couple things, like her baby brother being born and dying. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, most of the horrible things she does talk about. I think what the difference is, and it's sort of the difference between being a child and an adult. If you're a child and you're experiencing this and you have a good parents, you're sort of sheltered from that because you trust in them. And I think as readers, we trust Ma and Pa to see us through. So it isn't really, it's sort of like they're holding our hand, getting us through this. Whereas if you're an adult, you're stuck figuring out what to do about it. And that's one of the reasons I think that Laura did stop at the end of these happy golden years, because that's sort of the final transition to adulthood. And that would be just a totally different set of books when Laura has to be. It would be the books from Ma's point of view from then on in.
And you already mentioned Ma wasn't the fun parent.
No, she had a lot of work to do. And she really had really kind of a hard life. There's a bit of it that just comes through in this short story called Grandpa's Fiddle that Rose wrote. And Ma is reacting to something that happened to Almanzo. And she says, well, what would Laura have done if he had died? And sort of in that one little bit, all the fear that she must have felt while Charles went off and did all this stuff. I mean, every time he went out the door, he might not have come back. Right. And that must have been so hard on her. And in just that little bit, you get just that little peek of a window of thinking how Ma felt. And there was a show a couple of years ago called Frontier House, and they complained about that, that Laura never did this and Laura never did that. But it was sort of like, yeah, getting snow in June one time so you get a little cold. Yeah, I think there was worse things than that in the books if you actually read them.
What's your take on that, Caroline? When you looked back, I mean, there are a lot of hardships.
Yeah, and I think that that's actually one of the really fascinating things for adults to realize just, you know, how brutal this existence was and the really ingenious ways that people dealt with it. I mean, the self-reliance aspect, I think, is deeply fascinating to people now because it really describes how people lived before there was any kind of government assistance. There was no FEMA. There was no Red Cross. There was nothing. And so you dealt with it. And that, I think, is a really there are so many descriptions in the books of process, of how people did everything from building a log cabin to entertaining themselves. You know, the songs in the books are incredible. There's like over 120 songs and the making of music and the, you know, the singing to lift your spirits, basically, was the only thing they could do as a form of entertainment and to sort of bring the family together, I think remains a sort of fascinating thing to us today.
Well, and even the making of food is described in minute detail in a number of the books. And when I first picked up the books and started reading them to my daughter, she was a little too young for it, in Little House in the Big Woods, the descriptions of butchering and making cheese and all of the stuff, she was thinking, why are we reading this? But
and cheese is maybe a little too much for some people.
Right. So now that these books are part of the Library of America, what do you think that means?
I think it's the inclusion of the books as part of American literature, and that means with all of their flaws and their historical underpinnings, as well as their, you know, their lyricism and their classic quality. I mean, they do contain stereotypes. They contain racist language, but I think that's actually a really good way for people, whether they're adults, young adults in college or in high school, to grapple with issues like Manifest Destiny and Indian Territory. Some of these books do allude to some really fascinating and troubling parts of our past and offer a way into those areas for people who haven't learned about that stuff.
Do you think that there has been any... these books are beloved, but do you think that there's been any lack of respect for them as literature because they're books for kids?
Oh, sure. I think that you know, in the last few decades, children's literature has become more accepted in the canon. People realize how important these books are in terms of forming people's minds and people's expectations about literature, about life. But there has always been a sort of feeling like if it's for kids, it's not really that serious.
Caroline Fraser, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Caroline Fraser is the editor of the new edition of the complete works of Laura Ingalls Wilder, published by Library of America. She'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Iowa City Public Library in a visit co-sponsored by Prairie Lights Bookstore. Sarah Utoff, thank you so much. Sarah Utoff is a reference librarian at Kirkwood Community College and the director of the Oxford Library. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. We're going to stay on the topic of children's literature tomorrow. We're going to have picks for the best books for kids from this year. Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.